This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. This week, he's back. Former Mayor John Morgan wants back in politics, only this time he's looking to run provincially for the NDP. A new study that hopes to examine the effects of marijuana on youth will tell you all about it, turning a mountain into one of Cape Breton's favorite hiking destinations, and a police crackdown on texting while driving. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. Former Mayor John Morgan wants back in politics, only this time he's looking to run provincially for the NDP.
I think most of the former politicians continue to watch politics after they leave, and so I've never left in the sense of not paying attention or caring what was unfolding. And I always hoped that there'd be an opportunity to come back one day, but the path back wasn't clear. I was aware that the municipal government was going to be experiencing difficulties for a very long time until the equalization system that's got so much attention was addressed. But the only way to address that is really through the provincial government. And for a long time, it wasn't clear that there was going to be a provincial party that was going to be willing to look at that seriously and take the types of actions that are necessary in order for the region to have a chance to survive. And during the course of the last few months, Mr. Burrell contacted me, and we spent literally hours discussing the circumstances in CBRM and Cape Breton and Glace Bay and Dominion more specifically. And he convinced me that he intends to support the efforts to give this region a chance to survive. To thrive. And that made me take another look at politics and want to come back. And that's really what I think driving force. I've been working with Kendra Coombs in Waterford as well the last few weeks. And that sort of got one foot back into politics. And I guess I'd say that Gary got the other foot back in, and I'm fully immersed at this stage.
Before we get into some of the equalization issues you brought up, there is a mayoral election coming up this year. Some people might wonder, you know, why did you not decide to go back to that level of politics? Do you think everything you can do has been done there? Or
I loved the mayoralty position. I loved every day that I spent in the mayor's office. I woke up, as I said, to another media person, and every day was like Christmas to me when I was doing that job, in terms of the people that I was working with and the members of the public that you were able to support. And I thought we were able to do a different type of government as well from what is traditionally practiced, which was the people that I viewed as being most important, the people that we put in power, were ordinary people. So that if an ordinary person, not owning a large business or real estate in the downtown area, if they knocked on my door, they were as important or more important than any business owner. What mattered to me most was really what most of the people thought. And so we were able to implement another a type of government that I think is unusual, and because so much of government is dominated by big business, dominated by elite interests. And so it was a form of populism that supported ordinary people, and I was proud of what we were doing. But that having been said, there's a fundamental limitation in terms of municipal government locally in that it is a legislative child of the province, but more importantly, it's a fiscal and economic child of the province as well. And it operates within the constraints that the provincial government imposes on it, such that when the province starves it of money, as it has been doing for a very long time, it causes the tax rates to inflate, it causes the service levels to decline, and municipal representatives are left with almost impossible decisions to get right. There's no right answers for them, basically, and no answers left to them that allows the region to survive. And the provincial government gives has the capacity to actually fix those issues, to ensure that the people of our region have comparable services and comparable tax rates, to ensure that the Constitution is complied with. But that means that our residents have tax rates that allow residents, new buildings, residential buildings to be built, new commercial buildings to be constructed. And it means that you no longer have to not pave the roads if you have comparable services. And anybody driving on the roads today, they'll see potholes. And some people in the municipal government might say, well, it's just a time of year. But that greatly oversimplifies it, because what happens as the municipality cuts back on its road budget, the water penetrates the road surfaces and you get potholes a year later. It's inevitable.
And you're not blaming the municipality here. I sense you're more blaming the province than...
Absolutely. When we have those broken roads and those inflated tax rates, they are the inevitable consequence of provincial government policy toward the region. And unless we fix that, the region will continue to decline. It is an existential threat to the survival of the region. Our people are leaving rapidly. And I think the other thing that's important to note when we talk about the healthcare issues that are so important to everybody locally, and the lack of family physicians, the lack of specialists, one of the fundamental problems that the health authorities have in recruiting physicians and other professionals to the area is the challenge that the region has been had its infrastructure slowly taken or destroyed, slowly rotted away, and the services reduced. So the amenities that those professionals would be looking for when they look to come to a community, they're no longer here. And so it becomes very hard to get many of the professionals that we need, the doctors, the specialists, to deliver healthcare. And so really what you have is the provincial government engaging in an engineered implosion of the infrastructure and the demographics of the region.
Engineered? So that implies some deliberation on the province's part? You think they're deliberately imploding our infrastructure? You're going that far?
If you get access to some of the work that some of provincial officials have done on the population dynamics in Nova Scotia, what you see is a provincial government civil service that is aware of the depopulation of much of what they call rural Nova Scotia and Cape Breton Regional Municipality as well. Now, Cape Breton Regional Municipality is not rural, which is an important point, but they're aware of it, and their strategy is to manage that decline in rural areas, but not to resist it.
Well, let me take up a point here, because if it's really, or at least in significant part, a problem of bureaucracy rather than just this or that government, then I have to bring up the fact that this problem, to whatever extent it's bureaucratic or to whatever extent it's of government, existed during Mr. Dexter's tenure, and you were highly critical of him. And, your leader was a member of that government. So given the fact that the NDP didn't change much at the time as far as equalization goes, why should it be different this time around, should the NDP form a government?
There is a saying in government that personnel is policy. And I think that was the case in government in Nova Scotia for many, many years. I certainly did not easily go to any political party, and for that reason. I knew, for example, the finance minister in the NDP government. I was in law school with him. And to my mind, he was a very conservative young man at the time.
You're speaking of Graham Steele.
Very capable, very smart man, but to my mind, very conservative in his views of economics. And so I did not come to any political party easily. one thing that's fundamental is the region has to have a chance at survival. And in my conversations with Mr. Burrell, we talked about these very issues, that there has to be a path that the provincial government recognizes not just the individual inequality in the province, which Burrell is obviously very sees as a very urgent concern, but also the geographic inequality. And he made that point even before I did. So that's, to me, what is fundamental, that the party has a leader that represents all of the people of the province, that gives all of the people of the province a chance at survival. And so that is what enabled me to come to provincial politics with a sense of hope that things can be different in the future.
John, anything you want to add for our listeners?
Well, I think I just want to make the point that for many, many years, I think people have, in effect, given up in Cape Breton. And I say that with sadness, that there appeared to be nobody that would listen, no remaining avenue to fight back, to give the people of the region hope, a path to success. And I believe there is a path that we can make our future better than our recent past, and we can right some of the wrongs that have happened in recent years. And so I hope people will consider, first of all, supporting Kendra Coombs in the New Waterford race that is unfolding. It'll be an important first step, and supporting the party in the coming general election as well. And hopefully we'll have a team of people that can fight back effectively on behalf of the citizens of the region and bring fairness to an opportunity for success for our region.
An ongoing study on the effects of cannabis on youth by a Dalhousie University psychiatry professor, Dr. Philip Thibault, hopes his research will provide valuable information for both the medical community and those young people considering using marijuana.
Your research is focused on how cannabis affects young people. Can you explain the details of this study and maybe start out with who is participating and what is the age range?
So we are investigating the effects of cannabis on youth and young adults. So we are looking at an 18 to 35-year-old age group, primarily focused in that age range because it is also the age range where most mental health issues come out. So we are looking particularly in two groups of individuals. One group are individuals who have just developed a psychotic disorder. So we say they're in the early phase of psychosis. They would have been recruited from the Nova Scotia Early Psychosis Program, which is a specialized team around early phase psychosis. The other group is a healthy control population, so individuals who do not have a history or any current mental health issues. Both groups we would be recruiting for would have a variety of cannabis use. So we're not looking for any particular level of cannabis use because we're with the sample size that we have, we're going to be able to look at those who have very limited use, but as well as those who have a high rate of use as well.
How will the study findings be useful to the medical community as well as young people who are currently using cannabis or maybe they're thinking about experimenting with it?
Yeah, no, very good question. Well, we know there's been an association between cannabis use and the development of psychosis for quite some time. We're trying to better understand how that occurs and you know, what is the biological reason for that understanding. So we are looking at a particular part of the brain called brain white matter, and that's the white matter in our brain makes those connections between the different parts of our brain. And we know that the cannabis receptors actually are focused on that brain white matter in that particular age group, that 18 to 35, 18 to 25-year-old age group. So we are going to be looking at, for those individuals who have an illness and for those individuals who don't, that effects of the range of cannabis use on that connectivity in the brain. So that's going to be a very important piece of information for clinicians to know, because it also can help develop treatments down the road, but as well as just information for youth and young adults as well. And you know, when they're making their choices about cannabis use, it's important for them to have all the information on how it could potentially affect them. So part of this is that knowledge translation, and so that the youth can make those informed choices.
What technology are you using to view the images of the brain activity of the people in both groups? And in layman's terms, what is it exactly that you're looking for in those images?
Right. So we are focusing on magnetic resonance imaging, or MRI. I think most people are aware of, you know, the various MRI scans that we can get when we go to the hospital. We are using what's called a higher field strength magnet, an MRI, so a little bit fancier MRI machine, focusing, of course, on brain. So we are getting the images from the MRI of the brain. But from there, there's different techniques that we are using to look at that data. And we're using quite advanced techniques here at Dalhousie and NSHA for that. So that allows us to look at those white matter tracks in the brain in various ways. It'll look at, you know, the structural component of those tracks. It'll look at, you know, if those tracks are going in the right directions, or if there's, you know, a little bit more aberration to how they've been developed. And so it allows really sort of a kind of a fine-tuned anatomical look at those white matter tracks in the brain.
Why do you think there's a major contrast for some people who use marijuana or cannabis? Some people seem to become extremely paranoid, yet others are very comfortable and confident in social settings. It may seem to drive them to be more sociable.
Yes, and that's one thing that we're, you know, is obviously from that knowledge translation piece. For cannabis use, and I think really what our concerns are in mental health is not necessarily around the occasional use, and where we see the more negative outcomes is with that daily use or almost daily use that has started at a younger age, and more recently around the data around cannabis that has high THC content as well. Because, you know, our cannabis plants these days are different from, you know, the plant that existed in the 60s and 70s. So we know those are more risk factors. That said, as you mentioned, there are some people who probably have no negative effects with cannabis use. But there are people who would have negative outcomes with its use. And we don't know all the factors yet as to why that occurs. Part of that knowledge translation that we do is that if you are having some negative outcomes, if you're not feeling good when you are using cannabis, then you probably shouldn't, right? So there's enough factors about you as an individual which may end up producing negative outcomes down the road if you continue with the use of cannabis.
What results would you expect if you conducted a study much like this one using two groups, one with people who have not been diagnosed with some form of psychosis, same age group, 18 to 35, everything's the same except you replace cannabis with alcohol?
Yes, good question. And there actually has been more research on alcohol than there has been on cannabis. It's hard to say what kind of results or how similar or different that they would be. We know that alcohol actually biologically affects the brain different than cannabis, and alcohol is a bit more global effect on brain than it does with cannabis. So, I mean, that is an excellent study to do, especially within this age group as well, because of the alcohol use that's there, potential alcohol use that's there. And it's one thing that we're also looking at in sort of other ways within our clinic too is, you know, the differences between how cannabis and how alcohol use can affect the brain and its related outcomes.
How did your idea develop into an experiment that could eventually provide valuable information for people like those who are participating in this study?
It's an important area of research. Obviously, perhaps I'm biased in saying that. But I've been working with early intervention services for most of my career, actually. And we know that with early intervention services, with these specialized teams, that we can truly maximize an individual's outcomes, right? You know, recovery is possible. And you know, it's with anything in medicine. The earlier that you are there, earlier things are diagnosed, earlier things are treated, the better the outcomes. What I've noticed over the years is that, you know, those gains that are potentially made in early intervention services can be lost with that cannabis use. And so we need to be able to try and understand that better to be able to develop mechanisms and treatments to allow the individuals to gain the positive outcomes that we see within other individuals.
Do you think the results of your study would have provided helpful information to the decision makers before the federal government decided to give a green light on legalizing marijuana?
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting discussion. It's a little bit of a moot point now because legalization has happened. There was a lot of discussion and sometimes debate around how much information the government would need. They actually had a fair bit of information at that time, but they were moving ahead, and legalization was happening. Now, I think one thing that allowed this type of research and perhaps legalization has helped this type of research to be done, because it has been difficult in the past to research cannabis and when it was an illegal substance. So now that it is legal, it allows us to perhaps get in there and do some more research, and so we can better, again, inform the population, and in our particular cohort, be able to inform our youth and young adults.
Can you talk about some of the other members of your team? Who else is involved in helping you with this research?
Right. Well, yeah, to do any kind of this research, we have a fairly large team. We have a team both here in Halifax, and we also have a second site in London, Ontario. Dr. Palin Yapin at Western is helping us with that. And having the two sites allows us to get the sample size up quicker so that we can actually complete the research in a quicker time frame and get those results out. And we're also quite thankful for our funders for this research, because imaging research can be expensive, and fortunate to have our research from the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, as well as from Research Nova Scotia, too, who are funding this project.
In preparing for a study like this, did your team look at the factors that would show the difference of environments comparing London, Ontario to Nova Scotia, and that they are somewhat different, even if not significantly? Will this have an effect on your study findings?
Well, that's something that we will control for. The main thing, of course, what will be similar is the amounts of cannabis use in the population, and really that's what we're looking at. But we're also getting a very detailed picture of that cannabis use. So we'll be able to see and control for if there's a difference in the type of product, type of cannabis that's being used around London, Ontario versus what we're using here. Our initial look into it looks like it's actually really quite similar. Youth and young adults are using pretty much the same product across the board. But there's a number of different variables in research that we do control for when we look at the end results of our data.
Was it difficult to convince people to participate in this study?
No, actually. Again, we have two groups. We have a patient group, and we also have a healthy control group. We're ongoing. We have about another year left of our study, but the recruitment is going quite well. And so, that said, of course, we're always looking for individuals to sign up for the study as well.
How can people learn more about the research?
They can learn more about the study through the Department of Psychiatry, our website here at Dalhousie, and actually people can contact myself as well through that if they're interested in the study. Overall, the impacts of cannabis on brain mental health, there's a lot of great sites that people can access. The Canadian Centre for Substance Use is a great site, but as well as even the Government of Canada, they put a lot of information on knowledge translation on their site, and so it's fairly easy to search if people go in there.
It continues to draw both nature lovers and hikers all year round. Coxeth Mountain is one of this island's favorite hiking destinations. Andy Pittman is one of the many volunteers who use and develop the mountain to what it is today. He spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
What can you tell us about Coxeth Mountain and that area of Blackett's Lake before it became a hub for nature lovers and hikers?
Well, there were some people who used it for a trail, a rough trail before that. And a friend of mine, Robert McCharles, he came to me and we were talking about putting a a trail there for quite a few years, and then others joined in, and it came to fruition, you know, and it's just grown from there, you know. It's right now there's like 10 kilometers of trail, and it's getting improved every year, and there's actually 500 and better than there's more than 540 acres there that the board is stewards for. The ownership on paper is Coxeed Hills, but we don't look at it as being owners. We look at it as being stewards for it, for the visitors and for the community.
For anyone who hasn't been up Coxeed Mountain, can you paint a picture of what they can expect the first time they get to enjoy the scenery and the fresh air of taking in a hike in the area?
There's a trail, we call it Trail 1, the main trail, that's located at the T in the road, Black's Lake and Coxeed. And it's a trail that is aggressive at first. It's steep, but it's like life, inch by inch, life's a cinch, so there's no time limit on how long it takes to get up it. So if you just take your time and you're careful, you'll get along fine. And you have to be in decent physical shape, you know, to do that. Although I'll mention at this point, Bill, we do provide transportation at times for people that have mobility issues, and we'll take them up the mountain on the other trail, which we call the service road. And that service road goes up and goes to a trail. And we have an RTV and we bring challenge people to the top of the mountain. You know, we try to keep it open for everyone. So getting back to the main trail, it's steep starting out, and then there's a Y in the road to the western loop, which is not a groomed trail at all. It's a cut trail through the bush and across rocks that are like the moon, you know, and you cross that, and then there's a wet area that you have to go across, and you'll come out onto the northern loop. That trail is almost 4 kilometers, 3.7, I think it is, and it's a trail for the adventure. If you don't turn off on that western loop, you'll carry on forward, which most people do, like 99% go straight up to towards the cabin. But before you get to the cabin, it levels off around the western loop, and it's a nice wandering trail through different woods that's marked, like maple trees are marked at different intervals, and birch trees, and pine or hemlock, and they're marked to be informative for the hiker. And then as you go through a fern area and then your last little jump up, you'll come on to a look-off, which you can see the Myra Hills from there. You can see downtown Sydney. You can see Point Edward. You can see the water tank out on by the highway there. You can see the radar base out to Lingan Generating Plant. So you see a good part of the Cape Breton municipality. And if you continue on, not far from there, there's another rock outcrop. And if you stood there, you would see... If you look towards the west, northwest, you would see Boisdale Mountains and that area. And if you looked to the north or northeast, you would see the ferry terminal in North Sydney. On a clear day, you'll see Smoky. And it's just brilliant. It's just a wonderful area to spend some time and just relax. There's benches there, and it's you're not far from the cabin there. So we'd carry on towards the cabin, and the cabin is always open for visitors to stop and have their lunch or have a rest or read a book. And there's a couple of privies there for the public use. So that's the really resting place for the for most people. Although on the northern loop, if you left the cabin and you could either go right or left. If you go right, you go right, and then you take a quick left, and you're on the northern loop. And you'll, like it says, make a loop. And that loop is, I'm thinking it's, well, it's over 2 kilometers, and probably around 3. There's a nice covered picnic table there with a nice spot by a brook. You know, that also, you know, you could sit and relax and or just listen to the brook. Before you get to that spot, though, you're going to cross a bridge. And the 45th Squadron Engineers, they were incredible building that bridge for us. We supplied the material, and they had everything down. Just everybody had their job, and they worked so proficiently, even through the rain. It was amazing to see these young people, ladies and young men, just working together in unison. It was just incredible. And so after you cross the bridge, then you come to this shelter I was talking about, that by the brook, and it's a nice spot to stop. And during Celtic Colors now, we have entertainment in the cab and entertainment on the what we call the summit. That would be the look-off, and generally there's a bagpiper on the look-off, and storytellers in the cabin, and music in the cabin, music in the covered picnic table, so it's quite an event, and that's in the fall during Celtic Colors, so that allows people from away to really experience Cape Breton hospitality, because there's no charge to take that walk. We do have the hall, which we have oat cakes and tea there afterwards for a nominal fee. So, getting back to the Northern Loop, we take a walk through, and it's rolling hills. There's a look-off we call the Pinnacle, and it's like the girl on the ship, bow of the ship of the Titanic. It's like you're flying, because you're over the tops of the trees, and it's quite an experience. And it's right by the tall, huge hemlock tree, so pretty hard to miss. And if you're fortunate enough, you'll see some wildlife in the area. You may see some rabbits. You may see some partridge. We have seen a lynx family, which is an endangered species, and they're quite... we haven't seen them often, but we know they're there, and especially in the wintertime you'll see their tracks. So, and they're not a threat to humans, but they're very elusive to get a picture. But we did manage to get a picture of one of them, and sometimes they're you might see a deer or two. So it's you never know what's around the corner, and it's always a pleasant walk. Some people snowshoe it. And the board makes snowshoes available to people that or groups that want to try the snowshoeing. So that's always something new for some people, and it's quite enjoyable. After you finish the Northern Loop, you can go down the what we call the Patterson Trail. It's a shorter trail. And it comes out to the access road. Now, it's pretty easy walking down to the access road. And you'll come out near our containers where we keep our working equipment, and then about a third of the way down, or a quarter down the access road, keep your eye out for a look-off on the left. It's my favorite spot because you're overlooking Sydney River and the Sydney River Valley, and you see the river, and you see the 125 out on your left. But it's a spectacular view, and there's a bench there you can sit down and just relax and take it all in. And it's one of the most enjoyable spots for me, and I always think it's a great spot that God made for us to relax.
And there are plenty of examples and stories about people using the hills in Coxeth to make a change for the better in their lives. What are some examples of that, Andy?
Well, Bill, you know, it's like one man, he tried to get up the mountain seven times. He didn't, but the eighth time he did, and he does it quite often now, and he actually lost 160 pounds. His heart specialist came out to see what he was doing because it was incredible feat for him. It was really recharged our batteries to see that it can have that kind of effect on the on anybody. So you know, like, and it's like anything. It's a challenge. If you're up to the challenge, you know, you'll really enjoy it.
The social media accounts based on Coxeth Hills, they are often based on the posts and the interaction with the people who visit the sites. It's often based on a tip of the cap to the volunteers. What would you like to say about them, Andy?
Well, the best way I think I could put it, Bill, is like I believe it was a credit card commercial. They're priceless. And they are priceless to us. They're always willing. They come out to help, so, or they wouldn't come out. And we appreciate every volunteer and whatever time they can help us. We're 100% open to fit them in and appreciate them.
What's another example of someone using Coxeth Hills to turn their life around and become healthier?
Well, I've had a friend, actually, and he started using the mountain. And fitness-wise, yes, because it changed his mental attitude towards life 100%. And that's a big part of fitness that, unfortunately, we don't look at. And too often, not often enough. And because of the peaceful surroundings and time to reflect without, somebody interrupting, that's available there if you look for it. So that's a big part of it too. We have groups of school children which come up, and as part of their outdoor activity, and that's very rewarding also. And we make sure that everybody is able to participate, whether they're physically challenged or mentally challenged. We make sure that it's available to everyone. So and that openness helps to make ideal physical and mental venue for anyone that would like to do it.
It's certainly a popular spot for people all over Cape Breton, but the volunteers seem to be proud about the people who visit from all over the world. And what did they say about Coxeth Hills after experiencing it for the first time?
Well, the only continent that hasn't visited Coxeth Mountain is the Antarctica. Outside of that, we've had somebody from every continent in the world. It is quite a tourism draw, and so we're happy to see people spend an extra day to do that and help the economy here, which is very rewarding. We have cruise ships come now and visit, and Actually, they put on an extra cruise ship now to come and visit next fall. So that's also rewarding, and we've had no negative about the from our visitors about the hike, and that's the type of people that come and are up to, you know, that's what they want to do. They want to get out in the environment. They want to learn about the culture of the area, and hopefully in the future we'll offer them a nice traditional lunch, something like fish cakes and beans, or a nice fish chowder, and everything that that comes in, whether it's a donation or something that we put on that to help finance the project, goes right back into the project 100%. So, because it's all volunteers doing the work. And and whether it's 1 hour or 1 year, it doesn't matter. It's all pieces of the puzzle, and we can't get by without the hour or the week or the month or the day that somebody's willing to volunteer. And we appreciate every one of them.
Even after a significant snowstorm, you can go to Coxheath Mountain, and you can see the people aren't waiting for the snow to clear there. It's remarkable to see footprints, sometimes a foot somewhat deep in icy conditions. There's no winter weather that stops these people who are almost addicted to visiting there. Does that still surprise you, Andy, after all these years?
No, it doesn't, because once you do it once, you want to do it again, and you want to do it again in different conditions. You want to do it in the snow. You want to do it in the rain, because everything is different. There's more water in the spring coming down the waterfalls. In the wintertime, of course, things are level again, because the snow is just like a carpet. It's level. Yes, you know, you may sink in into it a bit if you don't have your snowshoes on, but that's fine. It's a challenge for some people too, but there's always someone. And generally, more than one. And then generally, there's half a dozen cars or more in the parking lot if you drive by. And that's people that are enjoying it on a daily or weekly basis, and sometimes on for the first time. So no, it's very well used, and we're happy to have it there for anyone to use.
Have you or the volunteers ever had any problems with vandalism there?
We have, you know, like I don't think anyone is not open to those challenges. We have installed cameras in some places, and that has deterred most of any activity like that. So, we pretty well see that it's policed by the people that use it, and they cherish it and they like it, and they watch for any potential hazard that may be there, and that kind of really polices itself.
As far as gathering enough funding to operate Coxheath Hills year round,
well, funding is always a challenge, no matter what group you're in, no different than a household. You know, like you have to have so much to operate on, and you have to stay within your budget. And sometimes we have to wait quite a while before we can do something that one project that we would like to do. You know, we would. There's lots of projects on our list we would like to do, but we've been going at a steady pace without any debt. You know. And with many thanks to, like with this recent renovation in the hall, we had the business community. And when you see the business community come like that, and then you see the different levels of government too, this last renovation, we had help from the municipal government and the federal government. You know, like with those partnerships, you know, like we were very fortunate to complete our our goal there as far as our renovation goes. So it's always a challenge, and not all times, you know, you get all three levels of government like we did on that instance, you know, but sometimes we're going it alone. You know, Trails Nova Scotia has always been good with us, you know, as far as helping us with a maintenance fee, you know, which is put to good use. And so these organizations and businesses and government, of course, they see the value of this, and they see the value of helping a community project in an area where funding isn't readily available. So we appreciate all the help that we get, right down to the private donation, you know, and it all adds up, you know, so it's we appreciate everyone.
And finally today, RCMP cracking down on people who are texting while driving. Just last month, dozens of drivers were charged with the offense. And as Corporal Lisa Croteau tells us, the statistics show it's a bigger problem than expected.
For the last couple of years, that's actually about average. And when I was looking at the numbers, actually, that number doesn't represent all of the RCMP Nova Scotia. It was actually 114, because it included also the Southeast Traffic Services in Halifax here. So there was a few, that section wasn't added. So there's actually 114 for the month of January, and that includes all of the RCMP Nova Scotia.
Even at 114, do you consider this to be a snapshot as to a bigger problem? Only 114 were caught, and is this a major concern for the police?
It is a concern. It is one of our causal factors that we about road safety that we try to enforce as much as possible, and that's one of our main priorities with distracted driving.
Is texting and driving as dangerous as drinking and driving?
It can be. Anytime you're taking your eyes off the road for just a couple of seconds, and it affects your reaction time, and it could lead to a serious collision or injury.
Does the RCMP have resources available or the authority to seize cell phone records if they suspect someone was texting prior to a collision or a traffic mishap?
There is. We can definitely, if there's witnesses around that may have observed what happened prior to the collision, we would look into that. And there are some judiciary processes that we can use to get either warrants for the phone or with our tech crimes unit to help us out as well.
The fines are expensive, and they increase with the first, second, and third offense. And how much are they?
So the first offense would be $237.50. Second offense would be $352.50. And a third would be $582.50.
Is the RCMP having a problem with repeat offenders?
Not offhand. It does happen on occasion, and again, we try to educate the people and let them know that not even with the ticket they may receive or the fine, we try to educate people and the public that it is something that is dangerous to do.
How does the police go about curbing the problem or raising awareness of the dangers of texting and driving?
It's one of our four causal factor for the fatal and serious injury collisions that we have for the province, and distracted driving puts everyone on the road at risk. So it is one thing that we're definitely looking into.
Switching it up here, those numbers of 114 people caught driving and texting last month. January brings another concern for safety on the roads and highways, and that's clearing snow and vehicle off vehicles before heading out on your travels. And this is something the police made a priority of, especially on storm days. Is that correct?
It does. Not having your vehicle cleared off, it puts yourself at risk and other people as well if they don't see you. Visibility is a big thing, especially when the weather is not the greatest. we're just reminding people to remove all the ice and snow on their car up there before they start driving down the road.
So a driver is not surprised to be pulled over when their vehicle is caked in ice and snow?
Oh, yes, exactly. Yeah, there's a charge under for obstructed windshields. And again, that's a $180 fine. So if anyone has a vehicle that they, if you can't see out your window, you're not going to be able to react or may not be have enough time to react to something that's happening near you. So we do stop people and lay charges if warranted for not having their vehicle cleared off.
Do you ever see a driver clear only a small square on the driver's side of the windshield?
Yes, actually, that does happen, and we do stop those people and get them to clear it off and lay the appropriate charges if warranted.
So it's not mandatory to have winter tires in Nova Scotia. Does this contribute to many traffic mishaps in the winter?
We're just advising people that to make sure their tires are in good condition, and winter tires are they have some benefits that are, and they're different than all-weather tires. So just planning ahead, try to have winter tires put on and make sure they're in good condition.
What are some other safety tips for driving in the winter?
Like we just mentioned, making sure they have winter tires or tires in good condition. Make sure everything's working on your vehicle, lights, signals, your wipers. Windshield fluid is also a good thing to have sometimes when you need some more if there's lots of precipitation and water coming from the other cars in front of you. Check your battery. Make sure your battery's good, especially for cold days like today. Make sure you have plenty of fuel. You never know when you're going to be stranded on the highway if there's any kind of other collision, or you may you don't want to run out of gas. Having your window scraper with you, a snow brush that you can use, having an emergency kit that is stocked as well, and keep your vehicle clear, like we mentioned, before heading out.
The move over law, when a driver approaches a vehicle driven by the police and a motorist on the highway or the road in the winter, the police are on higher alert during this time of year. Is that right?
It definitely is a challenge, and that's the thing. The law is to pull over and to go to 60 kilometers an hour if the speed limit is more than 60, and like if it's not safe to pull over, we're not asking people to do so if it's unsafe. So if it's safe to pull over to the next lane, do so, and then also to slow down to 60.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.